Welcome to Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Tara Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor at Investors Chronicle, and Rachel Winter, Senior Investment Manager at Killik & Company. Asia is associated with strong growth, and this is often reflected in this region's equity markets. However, this has not been without some volatility along the way. So Tara, how have Asian equities been doing recently?
Hi, Lenora. I'll take everyone through back how they've done for the most part this decade, because it really sets the context of how you should think about Asia. So between 2014, 2015, middle of the road, 7%. The US was the big story there. But then in 2016 and 2017, everything changed. And the MSCI Asia Pacific ex-Japan Index rose 63% over those 2 years. So, you know, these are substantial returns for a short-term time. And they were only behind emerging markets. Worth bearing in mind, there was quite a big crossover between the emerging markets and Asia Pacific region. Now, that was stellar growth, and going into 2018, everyone was very positive on the area, as they were with emerging markets in Europe and everything that had done well over that period. Global growth story, everything was good. And last year, this very much became unstuck, as I'm sure we are all well aware. It was down 9% last year, which is not the worst. It was not the worst region, but kind of lost around the same as the worst regions did. And this year, it's up 3.9%, which is about middle of the pack for the major regions. So, you know, as you mentioned in your intro, very volatile. But also, there's a lot of reasons as to why this happened. So last year's kind of, falling off was, as we talked about many times on this podcast and wrote about in the magazine, a lot of it is to do with China, trade wars, Chinese growth. A lot of Asian countries are interlinked with China. They're either importers or exporters of Chinese products. So there's always a knock-on effect that you have to account for. General global economic growth that slowed down. Well, the fundamentals weren't actually that bad, but the sentiment was it was slowing down quite a lot. Also, Asia, as our emerging markets, very much affected by what's happening in the US in terms of the strength of the dollar and the pace of interest rates and how they're rising. Asia is a very risk-on kind of market, and 2018 was not a risk-on kind of year. So I suppose that's the best way to sum up what's been happening there.
Okay. Now, when the market falls, this obviously also affects the funds that invest in them. But you've been speaking to a manager whose funds didn't bear the full force of Asian equity market falls last year. Who is this?
So this is Hugh Young, and the name might not spring to mind, and the main reason for this is that Hugh Young is head of Asian equities at Aberdeen Asset Management, and now Aberdeen Standard Investments. So they have a team approach, so he's not named on any funds, but he has very much been at the forefront of Aberdeen's Asia equity business for a very, very long time, I think since about 1991.
Yeah, highly respected Asian investor.
No, absolutely. Yeah. He's been managing Asia equities since 1985. He leads the team on quite popular and well-known trusts such as Aberdeen Asian Income and then Aberdeen Standard Asia Focus, which is their kind of small-cap Asian vehicle as well. Performance-wise, so the Aberdeen Asian team, I suppose they generally tilt towards value investing. So recent performance has to be taken with that in account, because the 2016-17 figures that I mentioned earlier was very much a growth kind of market. So over 3 years, the income trust has returned 58% versus 60 for its benchmark, which is the MSCI Asia Pacific ex-Japan Index. And the Asia Focus Trust has returned 47% versus 30% for the small cap equivalent index. 5 years, the figures are very different. So the income trust only returned 45 versus 72 and the small cap 41 versus 38. But as you mentioned before you asked me this question, 2018 is what's important here. So the Asian Income Trust only lost 6.2%, which actually is less than the 9% fall in the index. And similarly with the Small Cap Trust as well, that only lost 2.5% versus a 14% decline in its index. So,
okay, so good performance from the smaller companies.
Absolutely,
trust,
yeah. Very, very defensive.
Relative performance,
yes,
I would add.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it still lost money, it's worth bearing in mind.
But a lot less than the market.
No, absolutely, so, yeah, it really is. So, and there are reasons for this. They favour a very specific type of small cap, ones that align to kind of the domestic growth story, so they're less impacted by the kind of macro sentiment that I mentioned earlier. But the Asian income underperformance can be explained by them you know, it's an income trust and it's a value income trust, I suppose, as well. So it didn't invest in the major growth stock stories that we saw coming out of Asia, things like, you know, Baidu, Tencent, Alibaba, things like
right,
that. Well,
okay, so. Yeah, the cyclicals. So basically they're quite defensive funds. They kind of like do better in falling markets, lag rising markets type
absolutely,
of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So with the strategy, you're saying they don't go for, say, for example, big tech stocks. What kind of companies do they go for?
So they have a very strict criteria. It's very much a combination of quality quality stocks, strong balance sheets. Obviously, quality and income in the income trust, and then quality conservative in the small cap space. So big focus on balance sheets. The companies have little to no debt. The small cap stocks, actually, Hugh Young was telling me that they like to see no meaningful debt on the balance sheet. They're a bit more lenient for the income stocks. And they should be aligned to the domestic growth story. So by that, we're talking at their earnings and revenues growing at a multiple of the economic growth of the region that they're serving or the country that they're serving. And the main thing is they have to have the right culture. So the Aberdeen Asian team have a very strict business culture requirements. They, you know, they're looking for strong governance, reliable kind of business strategy, conservative business strategy as well. They don't want people going gung-ho. They want people to kind of incrementally increase what they're trying to do in a meaningful way. I'll give some examples. So in the small cap trust, you've got an Indonesian conservative private bank, and like things like local supermarket chains elsewhere as well. So these are kind of, you know, staple businesses, but that can do really well out of the economy growing. So this conservative private bank, they've owned for over 20 years. It managed to survive through the Asian financial crisis, which was in 1997, and kind of came out strong on the other end. And interestingly, in the income front, the equivalent of that is a conservative Singaporean bank, which actually recently became a major shareholder in the Indonesian private bank. So you can see how these strategies are aligned, and they kind of pick the same stocks as well.
What kind of companies don't they like?
As I said, yeah, very much never going to go for the stocks that are trading on 40 times earnings. You know, the BAT stocks, which is the Asian equivalent to the FANG stocks in the US, which is Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, Taiwan Semiconductor. These companies have done remarkably well and been big beneficiaries of the growth, the tech growth story and the global growth story that we saw in 2015, 2016 and prior to that as well. One thing they don't do, so I mentioned that they do like companies that are aligned to the domestic economy, but what a lot of people tend to do with that is pick the Asian manufacturers because they are kind of leveraging the cheap labor that's available in the different regions, move things around, and always manage to increase their margins. Hugh Young doesn't like that. He thinks they're very short-term plays. So if you want to really align yourself to a growing economy, you do so in more conservative ways like retailers, supermarkets, private banks, local financiers, things like that.
I think, as we mentioned, these Aberdeen funds typically lag rising markets but are fairly defensive in falling markets. So with this in mind, how does Hugh Young think Asian markets will do over the year ahead, and how does he think his funds will perform in them?
So he does think it's going to be a volatile market. In fact, he used the word somber Chinese economic growth, and just China is always going to be the biggest factor in this region as to how it does. It does really affect how everyone else does. So a volatile market. But he thinks his fund's actually going to do well. So what he said was is that the funds that he runs are tortoise rather than hare funds. And I think that's a nice analogy. And he thinks it's going to be the right kind of market. I mean, naturally, he would say that as well, though. But I don't think he would have said that in 2016. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt there. But, you know, there are some reasons why. So you look at the underlying holdings that he has. The Asian small cap fund is only on 11 times earning. You know, there is really good value
In its portfolio holdings.
He thinks, you know, eventually, although Asia isn't a market that always runs on fundamentals, it's very much sentiment driven. Over the long term, fundamentals hold out, and fundamentals hold out more in volatile markets. And if that's what we're expecting, then it should hold up quite well.
Okay, Rachel, what do you think of Asian equities at the moment, and are they likely to do well going ahead?
I think, as Taha has alluded to, Asian equities is really a very broad term. So within that, you'd have economies such as Vietnam, which is still very developing and very closed. You'd also have China, which is developing, but arguably on the way to becoming more developed. And then you'd have very developed, more stable economies like Japan. So I think if you're investing in Asian equities, you need to have a look at where you are investing within that underlying fund. I think broadly when people talk about Asian equities, they're really mainly referring to China. So looking at that at the moment, I think Chinese equities have come down a huge amount, largely due to the trade war. But I think they are reaching a point where they are starting to look very attractive. So if we look at the back end of last year, developed markets came down on average about 10%. The Chinese market was down more than 30%. And yes, it was right that it came down. There were many risks that people were worried about. But I think now it has come down to such an extent that those equities are starting to look attractively valued.
On that note, is it a good idea to allocate to them at the moment then?
Clearly they are very volatile. They are very up and down. But if you are an investor who can handle that, if that's not going to worry you too much, and if you are looking for growth in your portfolio, then yes, I think emerging markets, Asian equities, and particularly China are a good area to allocate to.
So are there any funds you'd suggest for getting exposure to Asian growth?
So if you want specifically China, I'd probably look at the Fidelity China Special Situations Trust. So as the name suggests, that's purely invested in China. It does have quite a high technology weighting, but I think if you are a growth investor, then that is a good space to be. If you want a more general Asian fund, you could look at the Stewart Investors Asia Pacific Leaders. So that one has been a lot more stable. It focuses on much larger companies. It doesn't have any exposure to China, but it focuses on quite a mix of developed and emerging markets. So it's got some Singapore, it's got some Hong Kong, it also has a large amount of India. So it's a very broad Asian equity fund.
Okay. Now, I think as Taha mentioned, Aberdeen, they run Asian growth funds, but they also run an Asian equity income fund. So do you think Asian equities are a good idea for income, or are they more of a growth play?
I think for some investors, they certainly are good for income. So any income investor, I think, should be diversifying as much as possible. Often we see that a lot of income investors will focus quite heavily on the UK because that is a market that tends to pay quite high rates of dividends. But I think it is important to be diversified, and I think Asia is definitely worth looking at. There are many stocks within Asian economies that do pay quite good dividends, particularly the financial sector. I think that is a good space to be, but clearly it is quite risky, so it's not for everyone.
Okay, and what are those risks, and how do they compare to UK equity income risks?
Probably the main risk for an income investor is the currency. So, for example, the Chinese currency has come down hugely over the last few months, and if you've got a dividend that's being declared in a foreign currency that's fallen, then that's going to be worth less when it's translated back into sterling. So for me, that is one of the key risks.
For investors who can tolerate that kind of risk, are there any Asian equity income funds that you'd suggest?
So one that we like that has got a very good long-term track record is the Prusik Asian Equity Income Fund. So that has a yield of about 3.5%. And because it is investing in very large, relatively stable companies, it also hasn't experienced a huge amount of volatility. So that's one that I would definitely have a look at.
Thank you, Rachel. Some really helpful points there. And see Taha's full interview with Hugh Young in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle of a website. Now, many investors are familiar with Asian equities, as we've just been talking about, and also emerging markets. But if you're seeking high growth and have a high risk appetite, there's another area you could consider: frontier markets. Now, Rachel, what exactly are frontier markets?
So these are markets that are so developing that they are not yet large enough or developed enough to be considered developing. So the stage before that is called frontier markets.
Okay, sort of emerging markets.
Exactly, emerging markets, emerging squared.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they're not as developed as emerging markets, but I suppose if you're going to weigh up, what they're like relative to emerging markets or developed markets, how, you know, what would be the main points there?
So I think there are definitely pros and cons here. Clearly, there is a risk because these economies are very, very developing. Some of them have quite poor corporate governance. Some of them have very inaccessible stock exchanges, and it might be quite difficult to sell shares once you have them. But on the other hand, they are a very good diversifier because they tend to move in quite different ways to developed and even emerging economies. I'd also say that another good thing is that most governments and most other countries have been quite reluctant to lend to these frontier markets. And as a result of that, most of them have very low levels of debt, which is definitely another advantage.
I suppose if you're an investor with the appropriate risk appetite, looking for some growth, are they a good area to consider at the moment?
I think so. They have come down recently largely because of sentiment. So they have come down along with other global markets. I don't think the fundamentals of those economies have really changed. And in fact, arguably they have improved. So for example, Vietnam is a major exporter. That would be considered to be a frontier market because of this sort of manufacturers have moved their manufacturing to Vietnam. So Vietnam is actually a beneficiary of this trade war. And that's an economy that I think is doing well at the moment. And that would probably be a constituent of many of these frontier funds.
You mentioned some generic risks to frontier markets. Are there any particular current risks that you should be very aware of if you're thinking of buying into one of these funds at the moment?
I think you need to be careful in terms of how you invest. So as I said earlier, some of the stocks within these markets are quite illiquid and it might be quite difficult to sell these stocks. So if you invest via an open-ended fund and you want to sell your position, it might be quite difficult for the fund manager to sell the underlying shares. So I would recommend accessing frontier markets via an investment trust. In my view, that's a much safer way to do it.
Okay, so are there any particular investment trusts that you would suggest?
So we in particular like the BlackRock Frontiers Investment Trust. Reasonable track record, very strong management team. It's very diversified in terms of the sectors that it looks at. And also, as an extra plus, it has a reasonable yield of over 3%.
Thank you, Rachel. Some really helpful suggestions. And see this week's big theme for more on frontier markets and funds with which to access them. As well as making a profit, an increasing number of investors want their money invested in assets that don't damage the environment or harm people and animals. There are many funds which purport to give investors such exposure, sometimes, but not always, referred to as ethical funds. But the problem is, there is no set definition of what such a fund is, no defined criteria that it has to meet, or even an agreed generic name by which to refer to these kinds of funds. Taha, you've been looking at this. What problems does this throw up for investors?
Oh, well, the first one is, as you alluded to in your opening bit, there are several terms which investors might come across on these kind of funds, and I'm just going to rattle through some of them.
I think a lot of people might generically refer to them as ethical funds.
Absolutely.
But they're not necessarily always...
No, they could be doing something that's entirely
a bit different,
ethics or however you would even define ethics. So you've got things like responsible, ethical, ESG, climate, sustainable... SRI, which is actually a combination of this.
Social responsible investing.
And the main problem is this, is these words only make sense to people who work in the marketing department of asset managers. They don't make sense to everyday investors or, quite frankly, anyone who works in the industry, unless you're in an asset manager. The key thing is, and this is what has become more apparent over time, is that investors do want these kind of funds. It is particularly younger investors, but they all know that that is an increasing cohort and it does matter. They want funds that account for their beliefs and their morals and that are doing the right things and doing good things as well as making a financial return. But as it stands, no one knows what these words mean. No one knows what the difference between ethical and responsible is, or climate and environment, or ESG screens. Shouldn't all companies have good governance? Why are there companies that are funds that are specifically focusing on this? And it's impossible to tell at a basic level what these funds do. So what that means is that when you're looking for a fund, you don't know what it does, you don't know how it does it, and you don't know how it compares to anything else. And I think the comparison is the main thing. It's impossible to compare. It's very difficult to find the best ESG fund because ESG means so many different things to so many different people. So you can't go like for like. As it stands, even if you're an investor that doesn't want to account for this, it's almost even difficult to find. To figure out which ones are vanilla funds and which ones might be ESG. There's no clear labeling, there's no clear definitions, and it's just a bit of a muddle for anyone who either is or isn't interested in this kind of investing.
Good news is, as you reported in this week's issue, there may be some help on the way for investors interested in ethical or responsible whatever funds. What is this help?
It's a starting point. It's the Investment Association, which is the trade body for all asset managers. And what it wants to do is it wants to create stricter definitions for the main terms that I just talked about. And it also wants to have fund labels. Now, for me, this is possibly the most important thing they want to do, because fund labels will make it a lot clearer to investors if a fund is aligned to a non-financial metric like an ESG screen or climate investing or impact investing and things like that. And as I say, that matters for both types of investors that either want to buy this fund and those that don't. There'll also be...
What do you mean by fund labels?
So there will be a clearer sign if a fund, let's say a fund takes an ESG screen, which means it screens out companies that don't meet certain criteria for either environmental records or governance records or social impact. that will be clearly labelled on the fund to say this is an ESG fund. Screen fund.
And ESG means,
this is what ESG means. But on top of this, and again, this is also a very good step, there'll be better disclosure from the fund to its investors about what it does and how it does it. Now, this is the main thing because, as I mentioned earlier, kind of, you know, an ethical fund, for example, ethics is a very, very subjective and relative term. You can't define what someone's ethics are in a strict grid or any kind of metric. But if funds have better disclosure about how they're picking stocks and what they define as ethics, then investors can make sure they're buying the right fund that is aligned to them.
Okay. Will this solution be effective in helping investors to identify and compare ethical funds?
I suppose it's wait and see. It's baby steps. It's definitely a start. As I say, everything is very subjective, so any clarity at this point in time is a good thing, I suppose. There are some suggestions that these funds should just have a different sector entirely. Maybe that could work. It's hard to say. The thing is that the financial performance of these funds is still very important, and being able to compare them against funds that don't take that screen is also very important. So though taking them out of the main sectors and putting them in their own sector, I'm not entirely sure that would solve.
And they're quite different to each other, aren't they?
They are.
I mean,
exactly.
You're not going to compare a UK ethical fund to a global ethical fund to a European fund to an ethical bond fund, are you?
You'd have the problem we have with the targeted absolute return sector, which is all the funds are in so different that you can't compare them to one another.
I think it makes sense to keep them in.
Yeah,
they're still doing the same things. UK funds of UK funds sort of thing, yeah.
The main thing is that it could just be a kind of a kick up the proverbial to the marketing departments to that they should be better at doing what they're meant to be doing, which is explaining what their products do. And I suppose if it does that, then that is a good start.
Okay. Rachel, do you think ethical funds are labelled clearly enough, or should there be more formal definitions of what they are and criteria they should meet?
Well, I think, as you said, I completely agree. The main issue is that the word ethical is so subjective. So, for example, a lot of our clients would say, I don't want to invest in Royal Dutch Shell because it's producing fossil fuels, it's polluting when you burn oil, it's polluting the environment. Whereas many others would say, I can see that Royal Dutch Shell is moving more towards gas, which is a cleaner burn, and also they're really expanding into renewables. So I'd see Royal Dutch Shell as a very ethical company. So very subjective. I don't think we're going to find one size fits all ethical definition. But I do think funds could clearly label how they themselves would define ethical. And I think following that, you've also got the issue of how you actually put an ethical fund together. So if you're starting a fund, do you start with no stocks and do you actively look for companies that you believe are ethical and then build a fund that way? Or do you do the opposite and start with all stocks within your particular universe and just take out the ones that you believe are unethical? So many, many different ways of doing it. And I just think some clarity about how different fund providers are approaching it would be very helpful.
Okay. Now, it could be some time before the Investment Association implements its proposals to try and help people. So what can investors do in the meantime to try and identify appropriate ethical investments for themselves?
I would have a look at the small print of these funds and see if they do give some of a definition of how they are picking what ethical investments are. If you can't find that, I would encourage you to get in touch with the investor relations team for that fund and see if they can give you some more information. And if you still can't get what you need, then I would simply have a look at other funds.
Okay, thank you, Rachel. Some really helpful tips. That brings us to the end of today's show, but you can read more on Asian equity income, frontier markets and ethical investing in this week's Investors Chronicle of the website. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.